interview with columnist and author Stephen Levy was interrupted twice by technical difficulties. There was also some dead space. Rather than trying to put it back together again, Steve has graciously agreed to start over from the beginning, so we would have one URL and we would have one show that we can then publish. So here we go again. As in the computer world, many times you have to do things over, no matter how annoying it is. We will start again.
It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmac13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too.
So once again, I want to thank my guest, author, columnist, and technology historian Steve Levy for agreeing to start over from the beginnings to have a complete show. I first met Steve over 30 years ago when we were part of a regularly scheduled monthly luncheon of writers called the Lunch Group. The group was composed of about 20 very talented writers, and the group, including Steve, Barbara, and I, collaborated on one of the best books that no one has ever read, Digital Deli. More on that later. Steve has been the freelance writer and the journalist, beginning in Philadelphia and moving to New York. He's written for such magazines as Popular Computing, which was the magazine that Barbara and I got our start with, Rolling Stone, and others. He was a longtime columnist for Newsweek and is now a regular contributor to Wired magazine. In addition to this, and perhaps even better known, he is the author of some of the best written and researched books on the history of the microcomputer age, beginning with the legendary 1984 classic Hackers, Heroes of the Continuing Revolution, and continuing up to the present with such well-received titles as Artificial Life, Insanely Great, Crypto, and right up to the recent In the Plex, dealing with our latest industry megapower, Google. We'll discuss these and many other things tonight with Stephen Levy. So now let's meet him. Good evening, Steve, and thanks again for remaining with us.
That's okay, John. Every minute with you is worth it, so have some more time.
All right. We mentioned earlier that you grew up in Philadelphia and you went to did you mention Temple High School? Is that
no,
connected?
No. I went to a Central High School.
Central High School is one of the oldest
high schools in America. It was an all-male high school at the time, which was not a great thing as far as I was concerned. A little later, it did allow in females, so I missed that. And then I went to Temple University after Central. And got an undergraduate degree there and went on to Penn State for a master's degree in literature.
Yeah, Barbara, who also grew up in Philadelphia, went to Lincoln High School, which has changed completely. It used to be a bigger high school. Now it's a smaller high school. They've changed the curriculum. It's really a different school.
Well, Central's still the same, though. They've had, you know, they're involved in all the horrible funding stuff going on there in Philadelphia. And they were going to close the library until some private donations came in and, you know, managed to keep a library open in a high school.
You mentioned that you wrote for a college paper at Temple, and you were the rock critic. Did you get to many concerts and to other things?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of lucked into it. The guy who was going to be the entertainment editor passed on what was the big plum, which was to get all the free records and go to the concerts for free, because he didn't like rock music. He liked theater. So I don't exactly know why he said okay when I asked if I could be the rock critic, but I had no track record, and so I became the rock critic of the Temple News, which was a lot of fun. I got to go to all the concerts in Philadelphia for free. It was great to, you know, when you go and ask a girl for a date, you could say, you know, well, I've got two great tickets to see the band or whoever else was coming back. And you get all these records. So that was a lot of fun. But that was the only brush I had with journalism for quite a while. I went on to Penn State to see if I can get an advanced degree in literature, then realized that probably my future wasn't in academia. During that time, I did an internship at the local newspaper and realized that you could be a writer and write about things that you didn't make up.
When Barbara went to Penn State, it was a culture shock because she had been one of the highest at Lincoln in her class. And when she got to Penn State, she found there were hundreds of other people like her. And off in the middle of nowhere with 40,000 students. So did you find any culture shock going out there to the middle of nowhere?
Not really. Temple was a huge school. I mean, it was nice to, you know, be on a campus there, you know, and it was a massive campus. At that point, you know, I really enjoyed Temple, actually. And when I went out to Penn State, I was a teaching fellow. You know, they paid your tuition, and then you had a little job as to teach composition to freshmen, which was interesting to be in the classroom there. It was a pretty big English department because we had to serve all those thousands and thousands of freshmen who all had to take our course. So that was kind of fun and interesting there to do that. I was always been an avid reader and just didn't like the way you had to analyze literature to be a literature professor. So I decided that wasn't going to be for me. And my plan, which was originally to be a professor and write on the side, went by the wayside. And, you know, like I went for it all and thought maybe I could just be a writer and not be a professor as my main source of income. I could try to do it from writing. Fortunately, that worked out.
Was John Chaney already at Temple when you were there?
John Chaney?
The basketball coach, the famous basketball coach.
Oh, yeah, of course he was, yeah. Yeah, he was a long-time coach. I was a big fan of the Big Five, the college basketball there. And when I got back to Philadelphia and started writing, I actually did some stories about the Big Five and the Palestra. And I remember Wally Jones rejoined the 76ers during that period. And I wrote about that. And Julius Erving actually came to the team. And I did a big story for Philadelphia Magazine about the 76ers in that year when Erving came. I remember I took Erving out to lunch one day, which was sort of amazing.
Probably the greatest big five basketball player ever just died a few weeks ago, Tom Gola.
That's true. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. He was a legend. When I was growing up, I always would, you know, beg my father to take me to the Palestra, you know, because you'd see these games, you know, played, and, you know, these great guys like Gola, Bill Melchione, Wally Jones, these legendary big five players.
Guy Rogers, Hal Lear, yeah, there are a bunch of them.
Yeah.
After you left Penn State and went back to Philadelphia, you rented an apartment from another of our Digital Deli collaborators, the co-developer of the first working electronic computer, ENIAC, J. Press Parecki. Oh, was that during your Temple years? And no, not well during your Temple years. It was Ibsen.
Yeah.
You're back.
That was afterwards. When I came back, I lived in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. It's kind of an interesting neighborhood. And every month I would write my rent check to the owner of the building. I knew nothing about computers and computer histories at the time, so the name didn't mean anything to me. But I remember the name because it was so unusual, J. Presper Eckert. I thought it was like something out of the Great Gatsby or something like that, but a bizarre name. So I never forgot it, and later when I wrote about computers and learned about the history, that name popped out of it. That same guy, and indeed it was. Many years later, I think it was 1996, I attended an event for the 50th anniversary of ENIAC. Unfortunately, Eckert had died the year before, but I did meet his widow, and I asked her if a building was still in the family, and she said, yes, it was. They still own that building on Wayne Avenue in Germantown there. So I did get confirmation it was him, and I even found the letter he wrote me telling me how to get my security deposit back.
So you weren't in any contact with him when we all did Digital Deli then?
No, I at that point I don't even think I put it together yet.
The ENIAC was the first of the big computer projects that the federal government undertook, and it was late. It was finished after World War II when it was supposed to be an aid in World War II, and it was way over budget. Since then, they say that nationally, 50% of the big projects costing millions of dollars are late, and very often they never get completed. So there was no surprise that we had this problem with the healthcare website, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, they were building the ENIAC for the first time, the first computer. So you can cut in some slack there. For healthcare.gov, it wasn't the first time you would build a computer system that served millions and millions of people. The government has computer systems already, and Social Security and other things that serve a lot of people. And certainly companies like Amazon and Google run massive computer infrastructure. So I would have expected better from the government. Though your general point is true, I think I wrote in Hackers, there's never been a software system has come in sooner than expected there. That just doesn't happen there.
Yeah, much of the analysis has of the project by even people that worked for the federal government, as I did years and years ago, said that it's not managed very well. And if you look at the project going to the Canadian company, when IBM, EDS, Hewlett-Packard, they all have track records of providing services to people. And the fact that they didn't bring in the Facebooks that have a billion customers or Amazon or others just to talk to them shows to me there was some problem with this whole thing.
Well, yeah, from what I understand, there was no one in charge. I mean, there was not one person who was the point person, the responsible person for the whole project, the CEO, so to speak, and each contractor is pointing to the other contractor and saying, "You should do this. You should do this." And so it was a pretty big disaster there. Ultimately, the guy on top has taken the hit for it.
Yeah, they even came out that they're accepting changes in the last 2 weeks, and they were untested. And you never do that with a project that's about to go live. Please tell the audience what your connection was to Einstein's brain and what it did to the rest of your career.
So I was working in 1978 for a magazine in New Jersey, a regional magazine, and my editor was fascinated with the idea that Einstein's brain had been removed from his head upon his death, ostensibly for study, but no one had heard anything about it. There was no study done. He looked all over. No one even knew what happened to the brain. He contacted the Einstein estate. They couldn't tell him anything. So he said to me, I want you to find Einstein's brain. It's our cover story in August. Go find it. And I had to locate this brain that had been missing for 23 years at the time, and I found it. I tracked it down to a couple of mason jars in Wichita, Kansas.
One of the quotes in my email signature is from Frank Tug McGraw. It was, "You got to believe." Tug was a pitcher for the New York Mets and the Philadelphia Phillies. He was a cartoonist. He was the father of country music star Tim McGraw, with whom he had a very complicated relationship. He was the author of one of the most raucous autobiographies I've ever read, some of which I can't go into on the air, and the victim after the long fight with brain cancer. To understand, you interviewed him once. Would you set the scene up for us and describe it for us?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so after, to go back a little, when I got back to Philadelphia after graduate school, I started basically teaching myself how to be a magazine writer. And the places I worked for were the Philadelphia Magazine and the Philadelphia Inquirer Sunday Magazine. They were the two big outlets for freelance writers in Philadelphia. And I would write about music and sports a lot, as well as, you know, just random subjects. You know, for music, I remember I interviewed Bob Marley for the Inquirer magazine, you know, which was amazing. But in this case, I got an assignment. Actually, they asked me to write about McGraw, who was working as the Phillies relief pitcher then, the closer. And, of course, every Philadelphia fan has, you know, been in his or her memory, him flopping his glove in his heart in the last inning of the sixth game of the 1980 World Series, where the Phillies won the first World Series ever, which we thought would never happen. But in this case, it was probably like 76, I'm guessing, where I did a profile of him and interviewed him a couple times, and remember once even went to his house. The deal was I would drive to his house, my little Volkswagen, and drive him to the stadium that day. He lived in New Jersey, and we went across the Waltman Bridge there. I remember being in his house, and he was arguing with his wife, and his kids were running around, and, you know, it was sort of chaotic. And, you know, that was the period I was realizing that, you know, celebrities are just like the rest of us, you know, with all these, you know, like mundane problems there. He was fun, and, you know, I'll never forget his, you know, his performance on the mound there.
I know that you and your wife, to be Teresa Carpenter, who would later win a Pulitzer Prize with The Village Voice, decided to come to New York together to strike out in the Big Apple. What led to that decision, and what did you first do when you got here?
So I met her at New Jersey Monthly. I found more than Einstein's brain there. I found, you know, my companion for life. And we decided that we would go to New York and to try our luck writing for national publications and, do national stories. And she connected with a Village Voice, became a staff writer there, and won a Pulitzer Prize for a series of true crime stories. And one of them just actually got put back online to people at Long Forms, asked her if they could reprint the story about the Playmate of the Year, who's Dorothy Stratton, who's got murdered by her husband, who then killed himself. And I started writing for places like New York Magazine and Esquire and Rolling Stone, where I became a contributing editor.
How'd you get hooked up with the lunch group that I mentioned earlier?
So it started when I started writing about technology. I got an assignment for Rolling Stone and just became fascinated by that world. I realized, you know, it was really exciting and really significant. Not many people were writing about it in magazines. There weren't hardly any books at all about it, as a matter of fact. It started becoming my specialty. I wrote about more and more. And this fellow, Steve Ditlia, decided he would gather all the writers in New York who were writing about this, and we would all get together once a month, I think, at the this pretty awful French restaurant on 46th Street. we took a whole back room there, you know, and it got to be pretty big. And it was a lot of fun. People like Phil Emmer, DeWitt of Time Magazine, and Doug Garr of Omni, and Deborah Wise of Business Week. You know, there were a lot of, you know, really interesting people. Of course, you were there, Barbara. Ditlev, you know, he was really excited about this whole thing. He kept saying, apparently he had also been a rock critic, and he compared it to the days when, you know, 70s rock, when Led Zeppelin was going around. And he said, we're on the tour bus of Led Zeppelin. He, you know, he was very excited and got this book deal at Workman to do this thing, the Digital Deli. And besides the people in the lunch group, he got this illustrious cast, J. Presper Eckert and other people to you know, do this book. And I wrote about the Apple II. It's the computer I used.
Yeah, the title became the Digital Deli by the lunch group and friends. And what friends they were, there's William F. Buckley, Henny Youngman, John D. McDonald, mystery writer, the great Ray Bradbury, Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, the fellows that developed the first spreadsheet that really became the application that that launched the internet age, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston, Teresa Carpenter, the aforementioned Pulitzer Prize winner, Timothy Leary, Kenny Youngman, and many other people. And
yeah, Timothy Leary, it's kind of funny, you know, because he was around the computer age then, you know. Yeah, and of course I knew him. I grew up in the 60s, came of age then. And, you know, there was a period of a few years where he was like this big novelty in the computer industry. And I remember there was this computer conference called Softdex. It was sort of the software version of the Comdex show. Did you go to that one, John?
Softdex, I may have. I don't remember that.
Yeah, Softcon. Softdex. Comdex, Softdex. It was in New Orleans. You would have remembered it because no one showed up. You know, none of the dealers showed up. There were no software dealers like there were hardware dealers. It was just, you know, software companies and journalists there. And the first day, people realized the conference itself was a bust in, you know, in terms of a conference floor. But everyone decided, we're in New Orleans. Let's have a good time. And I remember one night I went out to one of those John Brockman dinners he had that are called the Millionaire Dinners. Later they became the Billionaire Dinners. And, you know, and afterwards went out with Timothy Leary and a bunch of people. We went to Preservation Hall. And, you know, so that was kind of one of the bizarre scenes of the computer boom during the early 80s.
I remember Leary filming his own death and that was all over the internet when he was dying.
The ultimate trip.
Yeah. I remember the book party for Digital Deli at the New York Deli with Henny Youngman telling us jokes. The book was ahead of its time and sold poorly. The publisher, Workman Press, did a little advertising, and the only sale of significance was to one of our lunch group members, Esther Dyson, who's now a trained cosmonaut, and she's doing all sorts of things. And she sent a copy to all of the subscribers to her newsletter, a few hundred. I suspect that we sold less than 1,000 copies. The entire book is available free online, though, and I'd recommend it to anyone who wanted to know anything about the beginning of the computer age. www.atariarchives.org/deli, D-E-L-I. That's www.atariarchives.org/DELI. I wrote two rather boring pieces about computers on Wall Street based on my experience there, but there were some very interesting things there. You weren't married then, but you married not long after. How old is your son now? This will make me feel real old. I remember when he was born.
Yeah. We made it legit in 1988. I got married, and our son was born in 1990, and he's going to be 24 years old in about a week.
So, wow. What's he doing with his life?
So he wants to be a showrunner, create a TV show like that.
Okay.
He there's actually a trailer for this pilot that he got made. It's called 20 something, the number 20 and something, and you can watch the trailer for it, if you search around. And so he's doing that, and also working as a maitre d' to support himself.
Terrific. Our son Luke is a TV writer. He went to NYU at the Tisch School, and he's written for Alias, and he was the producer and the writer for that ABC Family Channel thing called Samurai Girl, and he's keeping busy. He has all
Great.
Sorts of things going. He's supporting himself out in West Hollywood, so we're very happy with that.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Whether he moved to Hollywood or not, I think it's probably going to have to happen.
Yeah, he finally packed up. The summer before he went out, he asked me if I could get him a bartender job based on my long experiences growing up in Inwood at the top of Manhattan Island. It was a real bar neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get him one for the summer. He wanted to have something to fall back on, but he's never had to use it, so he bartended for the summer. 1984 is the year the Digital Deli came out, but it was also the year that Hackers was published. Hackers is still my favorite book on computer history. And that made both the publishing world and the computer world sit up and take notice of Stephen Levy. The book is massive. It's over 500 pages. How long was it in process?
You know, I really worked like crazy for that book. I look back and I can't believe it. Now, the book was, like you say, close to 500 pages. But I really researched it and wrote it in about a year and a half. So, it goes to show when you're, in a frenzy, get stuff done. And it came out in the end of 84 was not, didn't, take off. It wasn't a bestseller or anything like that. But when it came out in paperback, fortunately, it wasn't so far ahead of its time that people didn't, pick it up, because then they started to pick it up, and, it's never been out of print. It's been reprinted many, many times. I've moved it to a couple different publishers, over time. Started with Doubleday, then went to Penguin when I was writing a lot of books, and most recently published a 25th anniversary edition with O'Reilly, and where you can get it now, both in print or on ebook.
In your second book, it was the only time that you veered away from the computer industry, Unicorn's Secret. What caused you to write that, and how much research did you have to do for that one?
So that was a book. I'd always been interested in this case, growing up in Philadelphia and being involved to some degree in all the stuff that went on in the 60s. I entered college in 1968, and that was an amazing time to be in college for those 4 years. Vietnam and all the other stuff happening there. And there was this guy in Philadelphia who was the leading hippie of Philadelphia, this guy named Ira Einhorn, who knew Allen Ginsberg and Abby Hoffman and all the rest of them. He organized the first BN in Philadelphia. He actually was on stage and emceed the biggest celebration for Earth Day, the first Earth Day. He was instrumental in participating in that. The people who were the organizers tried to write him out of the story, but there he was on stage running this thing in this giant event at Fairmount Park. During the 70s, he became sort of successful networking people together. He sort of did like the internet before there was an internet, circulating stuff about cutting edge science and other things. And he was funded by the Bell of PA, the telephone company. But he made the headlines in 1979 when the police, who were looking for his girlfriend, who had been missing for 18 months, searched his place and found her in her dead body, in a trunk in his apartment. And part of the time that her body was in there, he was a fellow at the Kennedy School of Government. Shows how connected the guy was. And he got a very low bail, and within a year, you know, of his arrest, before went to trial, he fled. He went on the lam. And I was always fascinated by this story there and decided to write a book about it, which I did. It's called The Unicorn Secret. And it's actually, it was a two-night miniseries on NBC some years later.
It was based on your book, the miniseries?
Yeah, it was.
That's terrific. I know the French granted them asylum for many years. Did you speak to any people that had anything to do with that in the French government?
Yeah. Well, they didn't give him asylum, but they denied, you know, so he got caught in part because of clues that I had in my book, which led the police to, you know, there was one guy in particular who was very vigilant in the DA's office in Philadelphia. He managed to track him down eventually. He never gave up on the case and caught him. He found him, but the French for a while refused extradition, in part because they misunderstood. They thought he was eligible for the death penalty in Pennsylvania, which he wasn't. And also he had been tried in absentia, and they didn't like that. And finally, they actually passed a law in Pennsylvania, which would have given him another trial if he wanted. I went out there a couple times. I talked to his lawyer. He wouldn't talk to me. He hates me because I had extensive, you know, quotes from his diary in my book, and I discovered that he'd almost killed two women before the one he actually did kill, an old friend, you know, which sort of blew his argument out of the water. He always said he was innocent, and the proof was that, you know, he's a guy who would never do that, that he actually almost did it twice before. So,
Did those women ever come forward, Steve?
Well, one of them I found on my own, and another one did go forward to the police after he was arrested. And this hadn't come out before, and you know, I was able to actually get the writings he did in his diary, which, you know, where he described doing this. You know, he described like attacking these women. It was sort of amazing. So I'm not a big favorite with him. And actually I got close to the family of the, you know, beautifully young woman who got murdered. Naomi Watts played her in the TV movie. But that was an interesting detour. And I found the book is depressing to write because, you know, it was a sad story about this, you know, very, you know, smart, you know, talented young woman who was murdered by a guy basically because she was leaving him and he didn't want her to leave him. He couldn't take the rejection. After that, I went back to the technology world and, you know, wrote five more books about technology so far after that.
I remember your third book, Artificial to Life. I've got a copy, as I have of the other books, and I was the president of the Apple User Group at the time. Then I had you as the guest speaker talking about the book. Tell us something about the book and whether you kept up with the people and the projects that you wrote about.
Sure. This is a book about, you know, how you could do biology with a computer, actually, with the goal of hard artificial life, you know, which would be to actually create life within a computer. A lot of people thought, this was possible, and they still think this. There's a big synthetic biology movement now, which tries to create life from inanimate objects, kind of a Frankenstein kind of thing. And then from a different point of view, it is useful to use the same processes we see occurring in biology within a computer, and you can use those to solve problems. There's this thing called genetic algorithms that actually uses an evolutionary theory to develop programs, you know, to grow programs, and sometimes they could do things much better than, you know, a regular programmer can do it there. And I've kept up with some of the people in there. One of the nice things about writing books is that you get a good relationship, a long-term relationship with your sources there. And, you know, often, you know, not the case with Ida Eichhorn, but, you know, like a lot of people in the other books, they become, you know, your friends, or at least you know, the people you know really well and go back to again and again. So that was the case in Artificial Life. And whenever I run into, you know, some of those people, it's really, you know, great to catch up.
All right. You had two very successful books that dealt with the inner workings of Apple Computer, and Stanley Great, which was the story of the development of the Macintosh, and The Perfect Thing that dealt with the development of the iPod. Now, Apple is notoriously difficult for journalists to get inside of. How'd you manage it? And please tell us about your early relationship with Steve Jobs.
So I started writing about Apple, actually, with Hackers. I wrote about Steve Wozniak. Did not talk to Steve Jobs for Hackers because he wasn't a hacker. Woz was really the, you know, the personality there who, you know, fit the themes of the book. But I did get to meet Steve when I did a story for Rolling Stone about the launch of the Macintosh. Because I was writing about this stuff, I was able to go to Rolling Stone and say, listen, this is something worth writing about. They didn't often write about computers back in 1983, 84. But I convinced them that this was a great story. The people who are working on it were interesting. This kind of company was something which was in tune with what their readers would do. And they gave me the assignment, and I met Steve Jobs, who was very unhappy, by the way, that the story was not going to be on the cover of Rolling Stone. You know, he almost didn't want to do it if it wasn't going to be on the cover, but he realized that you know, he had to accept reality in that case. He couldn't distort that reality. And he talked to me, and we had an amazing interview. Incidentally, the book itself, you know, Macintosh just had its 30th anniversary, and the book had its 20th anniversary. The book came out 10 years after the Macintosh, and I decided to do something special for that. So I appended to the e-book the transcript of that first interview I did with Steve Jobs there. It's like a 12,000-word transcript, and you can read, and it's kind of remarkable because he's much less guarded than he would be in future years. But in any case, that actually began a long relationship that I had with Steve Jobs. That really got to be much closer when I was at Newsweek years later, and he returned to Apple, and it was the point where every time Apple would come out with a product, you know, I would get a briefing or, you know, sometimes go there like a little early and see it. You know, can you make a picture of unveiling before me, sort of a dry run for his talk, or if not, I would get an audience after one of the Steve notes and go, you know, backstage and, you know, and interview him for a few minutes there. And, you know, and of course, we talk extensively about the iPod, because I did a big story for about the iPod for Newsweek there. So it was, you know, that relationship really, which like led them to open up more there. And, you know, when I did the book about the iPod, you know, they gave me a series of interviews, you know, to expose me to people that normally they didn't make available for interviews, like Jeff Robin, the guy who basically was one of the key designers of iTunes, and some of the other people, you know, Johnny Ive, for instance, I spent a lot of time with there, and he's very hard to get hold of these days there. So, you know, it was a great relationship, you know, and, you know, of course, we all miss Steve.
Yes, Steve's presentations were amazing. The first time I saw him in person was at the computer show in Chicago, where he first saw the Xerox product, the Star with Windows, like, on it, with the Internet connection. And he talked to the Apple user group people there, and he was very relaxed. Then we went to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, for the Rosen Conference, and he gave this wonderful talk on education and what they were doing with their educational programs and everything. But it was always in the jeans and very relaxed. Then I saw him years later in a three-piece suit doing the presentation for Next Step in New York, and he was as comfortable in the three-piece suit talking to business folks as he had been at the Rosen Conference in his jeans leaning on a table. So he gave great presentations.
No. I will not soon see the likes of him.
Yeah. The recent book on dogfight on the Apple Google differences. Mm-hmm. It turned out that tremendous presentation at the introduction to the iPhone was really smoke and mirrors, that nothing worked then, but he pulled it off, and by the time that they went live, things worked. So.
That's right, yeah. No, Fred Vogelstein, who was a colleague of mine at Wired, did a great job in that book.
Yeah, one of my favorites of your books is Crypto. The book is not only dealing with the development of tough encryption methodology, which most of the community thought was unbreakable until Snowden's revelations, but it also went into the stifling effect the government attempted to have on strong encryption, particularly in the interplay between IBM Lotus and the government over the encryption in notes. Would you tell us something about the book and what sparked your interest in the subject?
Yeah, well, I did a story for Wired magazine. Actually, I got the assignment before Wired even published an issue there. Kevin Kelly, who was one of the founding editors of Wired, asked me to write up these people called cypherpunks, sort of hackers of crypto. And this is in the early 90s. And I took the assignment as the second cover story for Wired and became fascinated with that subject. And I learned that there had been a revolution in cryptography and created by hackers, specifically this guy, Whit Diffie, who was working with a Stanford professor named Marty Hellman, basically invented a new way to do cryptography, which made it possible to do e-commerce and all sorts of other things with it, on things like digital money. I wrote about digital money in there. I did a story for Wired in 1994 about digital money, which was, we're seeing now come to fruition in Bitcoin. But during the 90s, we had these things called the crypto wars, where the government was trying to stifle strong cryptography. And, a lot of the issues that we see playing out now in the Snowden age were fought originally in the 90s there. And a lot of the same kinds of things, the questions about whether the government should tamper with crypto standards so they can, read them. And they had this thing called the Clipper chip they wanted to install there. So I had that deja vu, and when in the last couple months, I was working on a story that came out. It's in the current issue of Wired. The one that's is probably still in sale for another week. I did a huge story about the NSA and the technology companies there. And the whole time I was doing the book about crypto, I wanted to get inside the NSA, and I actually did interview some people at the NSA, but they wouldn't let me in the building there. But for this book, because there were some fans of crypto inside the NSA, they said they invited me down, and I spent 2.5 hours with the top people of the NSA, asking them about anything I wanted, basically all the issues of the Snowden era and how the tech companies were affected, and it was people including the head of the NSA, General Alexander. So that was a fascinating subject, and one which really made the reporting kind of special.
You may remember that when I was the New York editor for News Bites, I wrote a lot about the New York hackers and the police, and I was part of the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference, and that was about the time that the FBI had their plan where they wanted access given to them by the hardware companies and the communication companies to ensure that they could wiretap in this new digital age.
Right.
And I thought that was the reason that they indicted the New York hackers, including Fiber Optic and his friends, because it was a big story, and at the press conference they kept talking about that we're asking our friends in Congress to give us this what we need, because we've collected this massive data that we never could as we moved to digital. And I had Mark Brausch on about 2 months ago, and we talked about that. And we also talked about this this zero-day bug. Have you looked at that?
No.
The FBI has hired people who look for zero-day bugs. And
I asked the NSA about that, actually. And, they said if the vulnerability, the zero-day, vulnerability is so very significant, they said in one case they even did this, they found a huge zero-day, flaw that they could really go to town with. But it was so serious that after a lot of discussion, they decided they wouldn't exploit it, but they would tell the company, which I'm assuming is Microsoft, I'm not sure, that it existed, and they should fix it immediately there. But I thought it was interesting that they had the discussion about it.
For the audience, a zero-day bug is a bug that is in software that is released that the manufacturer didn't know about, and it could be from Microsoft, from Apple, from anyone providing software. Now the FBI had hired people to find these bugs, and then once they found them, they were using them as a way to get into the computers of people that they supposedly had warrants for, or that they had the ability to wiretap anyhow, and they were using that. Now the contention was that hackers and terrorists and pedophiles don't have special computers, so by leaving this unreported, that they were exposing us to hackers and identity thefts and the Chinese and other people. And
exactly,
they came out to the general public when an ACLU guy who knew something about these consultants but didn't quite know what they did found them on LinkedIn, and some of them they were bragging in their resumes about what they had done. So he brought that out, and I saw him and aforementioned Mark Roush talking about it, and it was Roush that made the point that number one, that it exposes all of us, and that number two, that he sure from his time with the Justice Department that the FBI's following established procedures in getting the ability to wiretap. But as the technology moves down to the local police forces, he's not so sure that that won't happen, or to other people who these consultants are working for. So it's an interesting question.
Sure.
What's your feeling on it? Should they be going back to the Apples and the Microsofts and all those and say, hey,
well,
you got a real problem?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, of course. And, basically, and the NSA even said this. They said that we have two missions. One is to intercept, gather foreign intelligence to keep us safe, and the other is to protect our security systems, our computer systems, also to keep us safe. And you're not protecting them if you see a flaw and you don't, help close it. Leaving us vulnerable, leaving a computer system vulnerable leaves us vulnerable. So it's very disturbing when, they'll use a zero-day bug and for their purposes, without helping fix it, because if they found it, chances are maybe the Chinese found it, or maybe sophisticated thieves found it.
On another topic, your newest book, In the Plex, deals with Google. Would you give us an overview of the book?
Sure. So I wanted to write a book about Google from the inside, as much as I could. I went on a trip in 2007 with a bunch of young Google managers around the world led by Marissa Mayer, and I got a really great inside view of the company that I'd never seen written about before So I proposed to them that why don't you just basically give me access to the company, sit on a lot of meetings and talk to whoever I wanted to talk to, you know, for a couple of years, and, you know, and they said okay. And I really got to tell the story of Google from the inside. And one thing in particular I wanted to do was look, you know, at the international side of Google, and wanted to pick one international office and, you know, tell the story of Google in that country. And, of course, I picked China, which turned out to be, you know, just the right one to do there. And I actually went out to China a couple times and, you know, spent time with their operations there. And, you know, Kai-Fu Lee, who was the head of their Google China operation there. And, you know, it really was the heart of the book to me, because it really called into question, you know, this moral standing that Google always said they had there, which really came under fire both internally and externally, because in order to operate in China, they had to censor their search results, which was anathema to, you know, Sergey Brin in particular, who came from Russia himself to avoid oppression.
Didn't they eventually pull the plug on that Google.ch?
Yes, they did, yeah. Yeah, and this has happened while I was reporting the book, is they, it turned out they had been hacked very badly in China, and that brought the whole thing to a head there. And, you know, from then on, that was sort of the last straw in, you know, like a list of, you know, other crises that I, you know, like wrote about in the book. And they decided that they can't do this anymore. They couldn't cooperate with the censorship anymore. So they moved their search engine. Well, they said they weren't going to censor the search results, which meant that they could no longer operate in China because, you know, when China demands that you block access, you know, and to, you know, these sites that report things that they don't want reported.
Once again, for the audience, there was the regular Google.com, where if you were to do a search on Tiananmen Square, it would show you the tanks rolling in and the guy standing in front of the tank and everything. On Google.ch, it would show you people sitting around with baby carriages in a nice, peaceful place. And,
one of the things the Chinese government wanted Google to do was censor the search results, not only inside of China, but censor the Chinese language results anywhere else in the world. And Google consistently refused to do that. Interestingly, Microsoft, people discovered, and, you know, like I seen it just came up again in the last couple of weeks, people doing searches in the United States in the Chinese language version of Bing find things censored to in a way that seems to serve the Chinese government there. And that's pretty disturbing.
Now, when they were censored, were they just blocked, or was it like the Google CH that you got some different nice thing?
Well, when they block something, you know, what Google would put in the bottom is saying you are not getting all the results there. Some of the results, you know, we can't show you.
Okay.
Google insisted on that.
Okay, but I mean, Bing,
Bing, you just didn't get them.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They didn't say they were blocking them. That, you know, that only people would do the search on Google, and they would see that the Tiananmen Square with the tanks, and they wouldn't see it in Bing. You know, I don't know if that's the specific example of that, but there were some sites that people did comparisons to and found the results were not showing up in Bing.
Have you read The Circle by Dave Eggers?
Yeah, I have.
What do you think of that? Because so many people have compared it to Google. I thought it was an extremely well done book, but it was obviously fantasized about
what might
happen.
Yeah, I think you really, there's sort of elements of Facebook and Google in there, more Google and Facebook culturally. But, I think that you really don't get a sense of Google from that book. But, you know, I think that some of the points he wants to make are points, you know, that we really should be looking at, particularly after the NSA thing, is that, you know, what's the effect not so much from the point of view of the companies. I think where he goes wrong is that he like sticks this on, you know, the people, the evil people running the company. You know, where in fact it's not an evil person running a company, which is our worry. The worry is that the arc of technology, you know, exposes us, exposes our information, and makes information valuable in a way that, you know, losing our privacy, you know, in a way makes life more efficient there. And I think it's us who's the worry. You know, how much privacy are we willing to give up rather than, you know, having people manipulate us to give away our privacy? You know, it's just the arc of technology, and what we find is convenient there. So I think, you know, because bigger points, you know, they're worth discussing.
The science fiction writer and college professor David Brin wrote the book the number of years ago, The End of Transparency, and the point was that there is no more there is no more privacy to get over it, but we should know what's going on. We should be able to inquire what's going on in the police stations who are watching us and all this. And it's
it's interesting, but good luck with that.
Let's move on to some current news. In the coverage of the succession at Microsoft, much has been made of the return of Bill Gates' active involvement in the firm he co-founded, what's described as a third of his time. In fact, I'm in the middle of a two-part series of columns on Gates' history with Microsoft. What's your opinion, if you've formed one, on the moves?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I know Satya a little. I've interviewed him a couple times, and he's a very smart guy. I hope he'll do a great job. But you know, if I were making a pick, I would have picked someone outside of Microsoft. I think they need that much shaking up. Now maybe he'll step up and, you know, do the things necessary to, you know, remake Microsoft as a more of a forward-thinking company. Bill is a genius, but again, I think he was, you know, serving the planet and all of us, in a much, you know, more useful way, you know, in his current position than he would be, spending a third of his time at Microsoft there. I would hate to have that distract him from the fantastic work he's been doing on his foundation. And I've actually stayed in touch with Bill quite a lot. He guest edited an issue of Wired in December. I interviewed him and Bill Clinton together. And I found him to be, you know, from a person who, you know, was really like focused on business and, you know, in a way that even the government, you know, declared him a, you know, predatory, illegal monopolist. He's now grown to be, you know, really, I think, one of the great philanthropists ever. It's really inspirational to talk to him and talk to him about getting rid of polio and kinds of other things. I wonder whether it's the best use of his time, and also whether him being away from technology for so long, he'll be able to give the advice that Microsoft needs to hear.
The first time that I met him in person was at that Rosen conference in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and he was noticeably shy and quiet. The one thing that he did tremendously well was he stayed away from the venture capitalists that wanted to own him. But I've been so impressed with the way he appears now on the Charlie Rose Show and other places where he's so much more in public command. I mean, he was always in command, but a lot of it was kind of a quiet command. Now I think he's an extremely good spokesman, as you mentioned, what he wants to do.
Yeah, and I've had a lot more fun interviewing him since he left Microsoft. So I hope it'll still be fun to interview him. I think I'm going to see him again at TED in a couple of weeks.
I remember the joke when Jobs was the interim CEO at Apple. The best available job in Silicon Valley was was the CEO's position at Apple, and the worst available job was a CEO because you'd have Steve Jobs looking over your shoulder. Now, I wonder if the same thing will happen at Microsoft. I would doubt it because they're different personalities, but there's always a possibility.
I don't think he wants to, take it over there. I think, but then again, the sentiment is probably the same. When Steve Jobs came back to Apple, he told me, he said, it's like, like seeing your car, this car you used to love, this beautiful sports car, like stuck in the mud and, like all messed up, and you want to, restore the car. Now Microsoft isn't in that bad situation. Apple was almost bankrupt when Steve got back there, and Microsoft's still making a lot of money, but I think the same principle applies.
On another topic, do you think the Department of Justice will involve itself in the Comcast-Time Warner deal? It's not only the merger of number one and number two in the industry, but it gives Comcast a much wider audience for its Universal NBC content, all this while we're debating net neutrality. What do you think about that?
Well, I hope they do. I can't imagine why, that merger should go through. I mean, it's no good for customers. They're not even pretending to say that they'll lower any prices there. I think that basically the government has just been too passive in general with the cable monopoly. It is a monopoly, it's just amazing to me that they're boasting. They're saying, well, we have no overlapping customers, and the question is, what's wrong with this picture here? Why do we give these, monopolies to cable companies and then let them own programming? It's insane. What's going on there, and how these regulations or regulators are lying down, and no one's speaking up for the consumer. And I really hope that this time, at least they don't let this thing go through.
Yeah, that's I would have thought that their acquisition of Universal NBC was a bigger problem, but that didn't get adjudicated. The only positive thing that I've heard is people in Manhattan tell me that they get extremely poor service from Time Warner, and Comcast seems to be known for its good service. Now, I've got Cablevision, so I don't have a horse
in the game. Well, Comcast is like, Time Warner is like the worst in customer service. Comcast is also very poor in customer service, but compared to Time Warner, it's better. I'm not sure. Yeah, but the idea is that you have nowhere else to go. And even if they do a better job, in terms of customer service and keeping the broadband going or whatever. You should have an alternative. You should have competition. And in other countries, what they've done is they've made the companies with the infrastructure make their infrastructure available to competitors. And that's what we need to do here. And we need the programmers. The programming, separated from the distributors, and the programmers should be, like forced to offer their wares to anyone offering, some sort of either broadband or cable television service there. Get some competition here, and I think then we'll see what we have in other countries, which is better service at a way lower price.
We had a similar thing, which I'm sure that you wrote about years ago, with the AT&T rulings, where they had to let other people use their wire,
right.
And that was a big deal then.
Sure.
You wrote eloquently on the death of Steve Jobs. You may remember that I've been a longtime user of Apple products back to when I was the president of the New York group, and the Macintosh been my long-term choice for my writing, and I still do my final editing on the and preparation for college teaching on the MacBook Pro. But the installation of Iowa 7 on the iPhone so distressed me when it might just destroy the display that I dumped the Apple phone and tablets for Android devices, a Samsung Galaxy Note 3, the Galaxy Gear Watch, and the Google Nexus 7 and 10 tablets. I do a lot of my writing, my columns, in the local Barnes & Noble, and I first went to a Chromebook, more recently to the Microsoft Surface 2, which I love, by the way. So after all that, in the nutshell, I'm obviously disappointed in the post-Jobs Apple and to Google on the descendancy. What's your opinion on the whole thing?
Well, I'm waiting to see what they come up with next. I'm not that down on as down iOS 7 as you are, but I feel that what they haven't done on phones is what they did consistently with the iPod, which is always that they had a huge lead and they all kept opening up the lead. You know, no one ever got close to them because they kept building on their lead there. You really can't say that with Android. I actually like the Moto X phone for Google's Motorola, which they're now going to sell to Lenovo. Like you said, you use a Samsung. There's not a night and day situation with Android and iPhone, like there was with the iPod and other things there. So I'm waiting for the next big iteration from Apple, and I'm waiting to see what Apple does in a new category, whether it's TV or wearables or what. That's really going to be the test there. But, and other things, I mean, like the new iPad is really nice. The iPad Mini, I agree with you about the Nexus Pad, but, I think the iPad Mini is really the current one. It's very pricey, but it's best in class.
Have you looked at the Sony watch? I've got the Gear, but the Gear only works with the Note 3. The Sony watch
works with any Android
device.
I've been looking at the Pebble. There's another small one I'm looking at, and right now the only thing on my wrist is one of those up bands.
I've got one of them too. What about the glasses? Have you spent time with the Google Glasses?
No, I haven't like really tested it out. Now that they have that work better with prescriptions, I might give it a shot.
Yeah, they've opened to that. So you still see Apple on the ascendancy?
I actually see Apple, on the top, but it remains to be seen whether it's going to be ascendant. That's what we have to see.
Okay.
We know it's great, but the question is it going to, maintain that? You can't stand still, or even iterate. You know, when Google Larry Page says time and time again that there's no point being 10% better than someone else. You have to try to be 10 or 100 times better in what you do.
And Google obviously did that with the search engines and with Gmail and other things. So,
right, yeah. So that's what they're shooting for. And if they flop like they did with Motorola, cut your losses and go on.
What are your feelings on Snowden personally, and on his revelations?
Well, I don't know him personally. I think we owe him a debt for letting us know what's going on and starting the discussion there. I think though, it makes me uncomfortable that someone, can get so much information out there, so much classified information. Some of the stuff is shocking and we totally should have known about it. We totally deserve to know about it. And other kinds of stuff is what you'd expect, and knowing the detail doesn't really help us and doesn't really help our security there. So, that's somewhat of a mixed bag. But overall, I think that he's done us a service.
Mark Rausch's point was that he agrees with the programs, but he thinks that there had to be public disclosure. So one of the problems is that there's no one to take the side of the citizen, because all of their results and everything, they're classified, they can't really have a debate on it. So you're just taking other people's words for the fact, well, we're not really doing that, So.
Yeah, well, I think that it's up to the administration to do that, and that's what's disappointing. I mean, in a way, you could say, look, the NSA, they interpret things very broadly. They interpret their specific rules they have very broadly. But they don't want to flagrantly violate their boundaries there. It's really up to the president to say, okay, I appreciate an aggressive intelligence agency, but you can't do this. This is wrong. I'm drawing the line here. And there's a number of programs that we've learned about through Snowden that I'm disappointed that the president didn't say, I understand why you want to do this, but we can't collect the metadata on every phone call made by U.S. citizens. And so I feel that if the NSA says, hey, we've interpreted it, it's legal for us to collect this information, we have all these controls on how we access it, it's up to the president to say, too far.
Did you read Bob O'Hara's book, Washington Post reported about 3 years ago, Nowhere to Hide?
No.
And he goes into the collection firms, the Axions and other firms who are gathering all of the data from the consumer purchases and from all sorts of other places and putting them together and in some cases selling data to the government that the government could not collect on its own, but they can buy it. And it's a terrific book. And these firms are kind of the shadow firms, but they're billion-dollar companies and data collection agencies. And it was interesting that's hardly mentioned. I expected his book to be a best-selling and an eye-opener. But for years in the computer industry, I know that the computer people, once they have the ability to collect data, so once you can build a database, and I have Steve Levy's purchases at Amazon over here, and I've got Steve Levy's bank account balances over here, and I've got Steve Levy's something else someplace else, the books he bought at Barnes & Noble, as a computer person, I'm going to want to put them all together because that's the most efficient way to do it. And if you leave computer people alone to do this stuff, they will do it. There has to be non-computer people saying, no, we really can't do that.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree.
What else would you like the audience to know about Stephen Levy?
I don't know. They can Google me, I guess, since I have no privacy, and find out. I think just that. I keep at it, you say we go back a while in this field, and I'm happy to say it's as interesting as it ever was, and I'm having as much fun as I ever was. So all I could say is just keep reading, folks.
Have you ever
more
wanted
to come?
Have you ever wanted to try your hand at fiction?
Not really. I think for me, real life is just too interesting is better than anything I can make up.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure. And once again, thank you for doing it over after the technical thing.
Okay.
I'll send you,
all right. Okay. All I'll, better the second time around, John.
Yeah,
so,
I'll send you the URL.
Okay, thank you.
And in the words of the Met radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with Al DiBello. As he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa,
bye-bye.
Steady, Silver.